From Kansas to Virginia, Arizona to Minnesota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as the GOP works to regain power in Washington, D.C., will it return to core principles or become Democrat light? Amity Schles from the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation is here with historical perspective. Andy Roth from the Club for Growth has the real story on the club's latest state legislative scorecards. The $1.9 trillion coronavirus recovery bill was just the start of the Biden administration's big spending plans. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks about the next big-ticket items. And after a long winter, spring is always welcome, but never more so than this year as the nation emerges from the COVID-19 pandemic. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Democrats have a tenuous hold on power in the nation's capital. Republicans are looking to reclaim control of Congress in 2022. But will they return to the party's conservative principles, or will they offer policies that are just Democrat light? Here to take a look at how that approach has worked in the past is Amity Schles. She is chairman of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. Amity, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Amity, in the aftermath of what occurred at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, it's now time for Republicans and specifically conservatives to determine how to move forward. There's some thought that maybe Republicans are going to go Democrat light. You want to talk about that and why it's not really a good idea?
Yes, thank you. Well, historically, Republicans move to the center after they find themselves in trouble. They redefine the party starting with the politics and say, let's get those voters, suburban families, right in the middle. Let's not be extreme. Let's be big tent, and then maybe we can win again or govern again. And an example of that would be Gerald Ford. Watergate was their trouble, their scandal, and Ford said, well, let's go to the center. Let's build a coalition. Let's build a coalition now. So you think of a think tank today would say, let's build the coalition. People are founding think tanks now. Let's build the coalition and think afterwards about what policy could be broad enough and friendly enough to serve that coalition. And what my co-author on this piece, Matt Denhardt, and I argue is that can be a wrong policy. And why? It starts with politics first and philosophy afterwards. The thing the Republicans do better with is to build their political philosophy, their intellectual, we could use that word philosophy, first, build the platform first, and then say, hey, let's see if we can get some votes for this, because it's right. And the counterexample there would be yet another scandal. That is Teapot Dome. And we scarcely remember what that is. That was a long time ago. Teapot Dome, what's that? It had to do with the West and oil reserves. But it was a serious scandal for the GOP, the most serious before Watergate in the early 20s. Why? The new GOP after World War II was a conservative GOP. And that GOP said, we want to get as much of the economy as possible into private hands, including all the things the government took over for World War I, and that would include energy, naval oil reserves. Let's privatize that or lease it to the private sector, just as you hear nowadays. But the leasing that happened with oil reserves was corrupt. There were friends of the president who got sweetheart deals. That's terrible, not only because they were sweetheart deals, but because the corrupt process besmirched the very idea of privatization. So they were extremely dirtied, the Republicans of the early 20s, by that. They said they were going to help the people by privatizing. Instead, they were only helping their friends. What kind of people are those people, asked the electorate. So Coolidge, who became president after Harding, who was the president of Teapot Dome, had a choice. He could go to the center and say, I'm the president for all, as Gerald Ford would later, Or he could say, I'm going to stick to what we promised and redeem the promise. Do what we said we were going to do, only Harding messed it up. I am going to fight for the private sector. And Coolidge corrected the Harding error and showed it was just an exception, that the Republican Party of the 20s was actually honest. It had promised it would cut taxes, it halved taxes. It had promised it would conduct all other measures in support of the private sector or to liberate the private sector fairly and equitably without rewarding its friends. He did that. He made his presidency about wiping the tarnish off the institution. That worked real well for him, by the way, worked real well for America. When he did run for president, he took an absolute majority, beating two other parties combined, very rare, and the economy boomed. So it's two models. Do you just start with politics, move to the center, try to make friends, or do you stick to your old ideas and try to execute on them better?
That's where we find ourselves today, Amity. And we're seeing people like Mitt Romney with his so-called Family Security Act and Tom Cotton and some others who are pushing for a federal hike in the minimum wage. Do you see the Republican Party at that same crossroads? And judging from what you've just said, I think I know how you would advise the party to proceed.
I do. And it's very, what happens is the political planners go to the politicians and say, you got to look like center so people will love you. You've got to have a child allowance. You've got to have a family allowance. You've got to, gee, that's good for families. And that's fine if it's politics. What's disconcerting and reduces the trust of the electorate is to maintain that such policies are optimal for economic growth. A child credit is nice. I'm the mother of four children myself, but it is not optimal economic policy. And we have so many child gifts in the tax code already that they actually work against each other sometimes and make the voter, the mother, the father just confused and more angry at the IRS and authorities. Little gifts are not optimal growth. And the truth is, the true truth is, if we had a capital gains rate, a rich man's tax reduced of 5%, everyone in America would have a job. Growth is better for the American people than little givebacks that pander to specific political groups, mothers with a lot of children, and so on. And so what is counterproductive for the GOP is to pretend such policy is optimal economics. That's the part where voters start to resent. We're in a non-election year. What do you do in a non-election year? You shore up your platform, make it clearer, better, wonderful. You don't go among politicians and wonder who might be the next presidential candidate. And what you see currently is an emphasis on personalities and future presidential material as if the horse race had already started. It hasn't. The GOP this year needs to focus on economics. It's basic project down history and return to its roots. There's also a thought that Reagan is passé. That's what Reagan did, by the way. He said, let's have lower taxes. That's what we're here for. Reagan is not passé. Reagan pulled us out not of a scandal, but of a terrible, scandalously poor economic period through his emphasis on traditional free market economics.
We have been talking with Amity Schles. Amity is co-editor of the autobiography of Calvin Coolidge. She also serves as chair of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, written an op-ed on this very topic. But Amity, tell us a little bit about the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. Also, if folks would like to read your book, where can they find it?
Thank you. I'm co-editor of this new Calvin Coolidge autobiography edition with Matthew Dennart. You can find it. It's got a picture of President Coolidge throwing a baseball out, happy picture, on Amazon. And if you want to help the Coolidge Foundation, go to coolidgefoundation.org and shop there. Coolidge is, generally speaking, an alternate for your children, a hero who you can look to. A different model of president, one who saved and who always kept his word.
Well, that certainly is different than a lot of things that are happening today. We hope folks will read all about Calvin Coolidge and visit the foundation. Amity Schles, back with us again. Amity, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth normally joins us at this time, but we are joined with a voice from the past, Andy Roth, who for many, many years did this segment with us here on American Radio Journal, is sitting in for Scott this week. Andy, really good to have you back with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Loman. It's been a long time.
It has. And Andy is still with the Club for Growth, but the Club for Growth Foundation, where he is executive director, it's a little bit of a different hat with the same organization. Andy, let's talk about scorecards, which are a major product of the Club for Growth Foundation. You have two different ones, but let's start out talking about the economic scorecard. Before we get into the latest results, tell our audience a little bit about what the scorecard is and how you go about developing it.
The Club for Growth has been around for over 20 years, but just a couple of years ago, we decided that we needed to expand our efforts into the education sphere, meaning that there were, with the rise of socialism and the progressive left, we felt it was absolutely vital that we educate the public about free markets and limited government. So we started the Club for Growth Foundation. And the Club for Growth Foundation has numerous projects that we're working on right now, but one of them is state scorecards. When we started this effort, we found that there aren't a lot of state scorecards across the country. We did an audit and found like there were some states that were well covered. There were some states that weren't covered at all. And we felt that this was just a missed opportunity for us to bring some serious accountability to the over 7,000 state lawmakers that represent voters in all the state legislatures. So we launched our state scorecard 2 years ago. And our ultimate goal is to do all 50 states, but we're slowly ramping up. So what we're doing is we're focusing on taxes, spending, regulation, occupational licensing, healthcare, a few others of the big state issues. And we started with states like Florida, Virginia, Arizona, and then we expanded even further to cover more states. And for 2021, we hope that we'll have over 20 states done.
The most recent state that you have completed a scorecard in is the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, of course, Andy, has become a key battleground state in presidential races, will be a battleground state for the U.S. Senate in 2022. But we're talking about state legislators here. Overall, as you look at the state house and the state Senate in Pennsylvania, how did Republicans in particular do on your new scorecard?
So, Loman, I don't know how you view Republicans or conservatives in the state legislatures, just in the abstract, but I always thought that they were probably better than those in Congress, just because they're closer to the voters, they're more sensitive to what the voters are saying, plus they can be more easily defeated at election time. But what I found was just the opposite, is that a lot of Republicans side with the Democrats and pass big government bills, a lot of times unanimously. In Pennsylvania, we saw Republicans did several good things. They fought the governor on his authoritarian pandemic maneuvers. They also fought him on environmental policies. But on the issues that people weren't really paying attention to, like cronyism or the budget, they just went along with the Democrats and spent more money, expanded the government, and basically left the taxpayer high and dry. So, and that's not just Pennsylvania. We see it all over the place. And there are places that are far worse and some that are far better. But this is very typical, is Republicans and Democrats getting together and really putting the screws to the taxpayer. And that's unfortunate. And that's why we're glad that we do this scorecard, so that we can shine a little bit of light on the issue.
Looking at that scorecard then, Andy, if we have listeners in Pennsylvania and the other states that you've referenced where you have done this economic scorecard, is there a place they can go to check how their particular state senator or state representative ranked or voted on this scorecard?
Yeah, sure thing. They can go to clubforgrowthfoundation.org and they can see all of our scorecards for all of the states we have available. They're welcome to reach out to us if they like through the website and urge us to do another state if they don't see theirs. But our hope is that we can start getting all of them done within a couple years.
Another type of scorecard you're doing, I find this to be particularly interesting, is a missed vote scorecard. What do you mean by that?
like I said, when we originally did an audit for state economic scorecards, and we found some states were doing it and some weren't, this is an area where nobody's paying attention to it. We could not find any organization, for-profit or nonprofit, who was keeping track of just attendance records for the state lawmakers. When we were doing an economic scorecard in Alabama, as we were sifting through the votes, we noticed that there were a lot of lawmakers who were not voting. They just simply were not voting. They were either not present, they were abstaining, or who knows where they were. So we were like, we've got to investigate this a little bit more. So we have found that there are several states where the members just simply don't vote that much. And it's troubling. Our missed vote scorecards do not pass judgment on why they miss. And I want to be clear about that. Some people will miss a lot of votes, maybe for medical reasons or family reasons or who knows, personal reasons. But we also have a lot of anecdotal evidence that they're literally ducking the vote. In some states, they will literally just, as they say, quote, take a walk if they don't want to upset leadership or they don't want to take a tough vote that they know they'll get hammered on by their constituents. So what we did, very similar to the economic scorecards, is that we issue a missed votes scorecard. And this is very new this year in 2021. All of the 50 state legislatures a few weeks ago were all in session, pretty much all of them. But Virginia was the first state to adjourn for the year. And so we quickly did a missed votes scorecard for Virginia and posted it to our website. Right after Virginia adjourned, Utah adjourned, so we posted that to our website. Pretty soon, New Mexico's going to adjourn, so we'll post that. And we're just going to go through the states, all 50 of them this time, and we're going to release these missed votes scorecards.
Andy Roth, now with the Club for Growth Foundation. We've been talking about their economic scorecard, also their missed vote scorecard. Andy, once again, just tell us what the foundation is very briefly and where can folks go to read the details of these scorecards?
The Club for Growth Foundation, like Thomas Jefferson himself, we believe in a free society that has an educated public and a transparent political process. So it's our mission to inform the public about the many benefits of economic freedom and limited government, especially at the state level. So if your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowthfoundation.org.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth Foundation. Andy, very good having you back with us. Thank you.
Thanks again, Loman. Take care.
The Biden administration is queuing up more big spending, and they plan to raise taxes to pay for it. We get details now from Eric Boehm at Reason Magazine.
It's been a little more than 2 weeks since President Joe Biden signed a $1.9 trillion spending bill. So naturally, the White House is already planning the next even bigger spending package. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Today, we're taking a closer look at the Biden administration's plans for a $3 trillion hike in federal spending. The New York Times reports this week that that money could be spent on infrastructure projects, climate change initiatives, free community college, and a variety of other Democratic priorities. The plan could also include higher taxes on businesses and wealthy individuals, but it seems highly unlikely that the tax increases would offset such a massive spending binge. And that means that Biden's plan is almost certain to add to the $28 trillion and rapidly increasing national debt. This is the big-time spending package that Biden has been promising since last year's presidential campaign, the Build Back Better plan that he touted on the campaign trail and after being elected. The pandemic bill, that $1.9 trillion spending bill, only a small fraction of which was actually dedicated to pandemic relief, well, that was merely a prelude, a down payment on what Biden wants to do. And the numbers here are really quite staggering. Consider the fact that in 2019, that was the last full budget year before the pandemic hit and government spending went through the roof. In 2019, the federal government spent a grand total of $4.4 trillion. That's everything from Social Security to defense spending to any sort of grant program that the government might run. Combined, that's $4.4 trillion total. Now, combined with the bill that already passed in March, Biden's new proposal represents nearly $5 trillion in new spending, just new spending, above the existing budget baseline. The specifics of the proposal remain in flux, of course, and we'll have to wait and see when they are formally announced before we can really critique them in detail. But this upcoming $3 trillion package is going to be called an infrastructure bill, but much of the spending will be directed towards other things. The New York Times reports that right now only about $1 trillion of the proposed spending would be directed towards what we traditionally think of as infrastructure items, things like roads, bridges, improvements to ports or to the American electrical grid. The rest of the package will probably be packed with progressive policy items. Stop me if you've heard this one before, including new paid family leave, free community college, and universal pre-K. The estimated $3 trillion price tag also does not include the cost of extending some temporary tax cuts, including the new child tax credit that was expanded by the American Rescue Plan passed earlier this month. The Times also reports that Biden is aiming to raise top individual income tax rates from 37% back up to 39.6%. That's where they were before the Trump tax cuts a few years ago, and that he may propose lowering the threshold for that top rate down to $400,000 annually. Currently, it only applies to individuals who earn more than $500,000 and couples who earn at least $600,000 a year. Biden's team is also kicking around ideas like raising the corporate income tax rate from 21% to 28% and imposing higher capital gains taxes on individuals who make more than $1 million. Preliminary analyses of the possible tax hikes show that they would transfer as much as $2 trillion from the private sector to the government, and that would cost jobs and reduce wages for American workers because, of course, that's what higher taxes do. Every dollar that the federal government drains from the economy is a dollar that cannot be used to grow a business, cannot be used to purchase new equipment, and cannot be paid to workers or to shareholders. We'll have to wait and see the specifics of Biden's tax plan before getting into them in any detail, but a preliminary analysis by the Tax Policy Center says that they would reduce America's GDP by about 0.5% annually for the rest of the coming decade. The corporate tax hike alone would reduce long-term economic growth by about 0.8% and kill 160,000 jobs. That's according to an analysis by the Tax Foundation, a nonpartisan think tank in D.C., as significant as the tax increases might be, however, the mounting national debt probably represents a more serious consequence for the Biden administration's plans. Before the American Rescue Plan passed, this year's budget was estimated to be $2.3 trillion in the red. It may be close to being twice that high now before any further borrowing for the infrastructure bill is included. Thanks to a splurge of federal spending before and during the COVID-19 pandemic, the national debt is now larger than the entire American economy. On its current trajectory, that is, even without any additional new spending, the national debt is projected to grow to double the size of the economy within the next 25 years. And even if the outlandish amounts of debt that we're currently racking up don't trigger a major fiscal crisis in the years to come, merely making interest payments on it will reduce long-term economic growth and American standard of living. Politically, Biden's upcoming infrastructure plan is going to be a major political test for both parties. With slim congressional majorities, Democrats will have to convince potentially vulnerable members from purple districts and states to support a massive spending bill packed with progressive agenda items. Republicans, meanwhile, have largely abandoned any interest in making fiscal policy a political background and have retreated into nonstop culture wars, but maybe that will change. Speaking on the Senate floor on Monday afternoon, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell warned that Biden's so-called infrastructure proposal might, quote, actually be a Trojan horse for massive tax hikes and other job-killing left-wing policies. That does seem like a pretty apt description of what Biden's advisors are preparing. We'll have to wait and see whether Republicans can mount any sort of an effective opposition. If not, another $3 trillion in spending could be coming down the pike before the $1.9 trillion that was just passed gets out the door. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the Biden administration and everything happening in D.C. right now at Reason.com. And you can catch me again next week right here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
After a long winter, spring is welcome. And with light at the end of the COVID-19 pandemic tunnel, It is an especially hopeful season this year. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
I am an optimist, and I love spring. Spring uplifts my soul. It's the season of new life and new possibilities. Spring is also a metaphor for forgiveness. Whatever happened in the last season can be buried. Life begins anew with no carryover resentment from the past. Spring reminds us to start where we are. The renewal of spring is the healing from grief. And this year, spring heralds our emergence from the pessimism of COVID-driven isolation and loneliness. Have we ever needed to emerge from winter more than this year? It is in spring that we first notice that the days are getting longer and the nights shorter. Spring also teaches us to lean into the future with a sense of optimism. Spring encourages us to persist in whatever we're doing, even if it does not yet appear to show signs of life. The great composer Gustav Mahler expressed the freedom of spring and the escape from the confines of winter when he said, "Spring won't let me stay in this house any longer. I must get out and breathe the air deeply again." Pastor and preacher Virgil Kraft adds a touch of spiritual awe when he says, "Spring shows what God can do with a drab and dirty world." I am a golfer, and where I live, spring is the start of the golf season. My office looks out on a golf course all year long, but it is in spring that I once again nurture the hope that this year will be the year of the breakthrough in my game. It's also the start of the baseball season, spring training. The so-called boys of summer start their play in the spring. This spring, I find myself hoping that our tragically divided nation will begin the healing process, the coming together of our people around the values we share rather than being driven apart by the differences we aggregate. Where is the national leader of the 21st century who can replicate the patriotism of Frederick Douglass, who, although he personally endured the physical, verbal, and societal abuses of slavery and prejudice, nonetheless drew people together, not apart, by returning to the values of America expressed in the Declaration of Independence? That's the kind of unifying leadership we see too little of today. Politics in a two-party system almost always devolves into a binary process of mutual opposition rather than a unifying process of shared vision and values. Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell should step outside their elegant but stale-aired offices in the Capitol and inhale the sweet fragrance of spring. They might find that they at least agree on that, that spring is a season of hope. Maybe the simplest statement on spring that I came across in preparing this commentary came from the sadly departed but great comedian Robin Williams. Spring is nature's way of saying, "Let's party." Yes, let's party indeed. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KDLC-FM, WJNI-AM, and WGUO-FM, all in Yuma, Louisiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.